Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome once again to the Explaining History podcast. Now, a few weeks ago, or probably months ago as it is now, I was beginning to look at post-war French fascism. The fascism that reasserted itself very, very gradually after 1945 and was a kind of a continuation of France's Vichy regime, or at least these were the figures who had survived France's Vichy regime and began to slowly re-emerge, much as fascists in Italy and in Germany managed to largely avoid imprisonment or indeed capital punishment for the most part at the end of the Second World War. Because we see things like the Nuremberg trials with the Nazis going on trial and are aware that Pierre Laval was taken out and shot and the people like Mussolini were killed off, there's a widespread misapprehension about the kind of the percentages in most European countries of fascists that were got rid of. And it's a tiny, tiny number. In most cases, the various tiers of administration and police, judges, civil servants and army officers managed to reassimilate themselves into European societies in places like France and Italy and also Germany, with not necessarily ease, but with relatively few obstacles. So now we're returning to Roger Eatwell's book, Fascism, A History, and he writes, "While mainstream political life was reviving, former fascists and leading supporters of the Vichy government were initially forced to live a more precarious existence. But the enthusiasm for the purge, the post-war purge of Vichy, people associated with Vichy, enthusiasm for the purge died quickly after 1945. It had served its purpose. Besides, by 1947, the onset of the Cold War had turned the spotlight onto the communists as the new enemy. One sign of the times was the re-emergence in 1947 of an Action Française periodical, Aspect de France, edited by Javier Vallette, who was also a former commissioner of Jewish affairs in the Vichy government. That, by the way, is code for completely and utterly complicit in the Holocaust. It was the commissioners for Jewish affairs in places like France, Belgium, and the Netherlands, who were responsible for working out how many Jews there were, where they were, and how quickly they could be moved to transit camps, then onto trains and into Poland to find their death at places like Auschwitz-Birkenau. Those regional officials and their compliance were what people like Reinhard Heydrich, when he called the Wannsee Conference together, were reliant on. Countries like France that wished to rapidly rebuild after the war, quite keen on receiving martial aid, and also needing to fight a colonial war in Indochina, public policy and the shift, the transitions in kind of political tendencies, political trends, all for these very reasons moved against communism in the mid to late 1940s. Fascists could rebrand themselves as anti-communists and emerge with a degree of respectability into public life. Anything that they might have been associated with in the war, they could say, well, you see, we had this terrible fear of communism in the 1930s in France. We had the threat of the communists perhaps in 1936 even being part of a popular front government. These were difficult times and things had to be done. And now we're back in those times because, look, we've got the threat of the Soviet Union and subversion and all this kind of stuff. And there are, you know, communists in our society. Of all European countries, communism had been intensely fashionable within intellectual circles in France. By the early 1950s, writes Roger Eatwell, a variety of other journals and groups had been formed, such as Jeune Nation, which was set up by Pierre Sidos, whose father had been executed at the end of the war for being a leading member of the Milice, which is the fascist militia. And the Jeune Nation adopted its emblem as the Celtic Cross, a symbol previously carried by the French Waffen-SS Charlemagne Division. Although these groups and journals had small memberships, they actively kept alive non-conformist traditions and sought new supporters. The most important figure in the re-emergence of radical nationalism was Maurice Bardèche, one of the few significant people outside the ranks of violent extremism who was willing after 1945 to proclaim openly, "I am a fascist." Bardèche, who married Robert Brasillach's sister, was an academic who had been sacked from his post for briefly imprisoned at the end of the war. His crime was writing for extremist publications. Ostracised from academic life, though, he went on to write some notable works on French literature. Bardèche turned to polemics and ideology. In 1947, he published a strong defence of collaboration and an attack on the resistance myth. He followed this with various works challenging the validity of the Nuremberg trials and various points about evidence relating to the Holocaust. So here, in many ways, are some of the kind of the founding ideas of post-war fascism. This kind of historical revisionism, well, it's not even revisionism, it's a blatant dishonesty about the Second World War. Challenging the validity of the Nuremberg trials, saying, you know, well, what had these men really done that was very much worse than anything the Allies had done? Of course, Holocaust denial. Holocaust denial becomes a much more significant part of the kind of the global neo-fascist discourse in the kind of 60s, 70s and 80s. And Holocaust denial, in a way, follows the gradual development of kind of a Holocaust consciousness. In the 1940s and 50s, by and large, in countries like, particularly in countries like Britain and America, the understanding of the Holocaust is fairly slim. In France, it's a fundamentally different proposition, because there had been French officials that had been chiefly involved in it. French police officers had taken Jews to transit camps. French railway workers had driven the trains, manned the trains that had taken them from France into Germany and from Germany into Poland. There was, you know, under the Vichy regime, huge complicity in the Holocaust in a way that the British and the French, the British and the Americans, who'd never been occupied, obviously, were able to, never have to deal with. I mean, there is obviously anti-Semitism in both those societies that function in different ways. But the awareness of the Holocaust is something that becomes far more significant from the 1960s, at least, onwards. And then by the 1970s and 80s, absolutely a huge part of international public discourse. Roger Ewell writes, in 1951 found Bardesh travelling abroad to meet Sir Oswald Mosley, members of the Italian Social Movement and other neo-fascists in an attempt to found a European neo-fascist international. Like most intellectual fascists, Bardesh sought to defend European as well as French civilization, though in keeping with the French political tradition, he tended to equate the two. Now, this was, again, a key part of kind of Nazi justifications for Nazi crimes, that the Nazis were attempting to save all of Europe from the threat of the Jews. And the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union was a last-ditch attempt to save Europe from Bolshevization. And the Nazis viewed German culture as being the kind of the epitome, the high point of all European culture. But the Germany's historic task in the Nazis' eyes was to save Europe, and particularly save this idea of European culture, and the French fascism positioned itself in much the same way. Then again, it's fairly obvious to say that most French fascists, with the experience of things like the Charlemagne division of the SS, most French fascists gained their views and their kind of ideological positioning from the Nazis themselves, and from the Vichy regime, which was obviously entirely compatible with Nazism. The Front National is founded by a former French SS officer. Roger Ewell writes, later that year, 1951, he set up a monthly journal, appropriately named Defense de l'Occident, which over the next two decades was to be a particularly important source for more serious European neo-fascist thought. Bardesh portrayed fascism as an attempt to synthesize nationalism and socialism in order to achieve a gradual revolution in values. As such, he held that Hitler had departed significantly from the model and saw no significant connection between fascism and allegedly contemporary examples like Franco's Spain. Rather, he argued that the fascist ideal was most clearly encapsulated in theory, if not always in practice, of the Sallow Republic at the closing phase of Italian fascism, where Mussolini had sought to return to his radical roots. The Sallow Republic was, of course, far more repressive and violent than the previous kind of iteration of Italian fascism that Mussolini had led up to 1943. Bardesh's main concern was to fight the battle at the level of ideas. By 1951, other supporters of Vichy were re-emerging on the electoral front. They rallied in particular behind a new grouping called the Union of National and Independent Republicans. which contested a limited number of seats, mainly those where there was a tradition of extremist voting, and returned 4 deputies to the National Assembly. Among those returns was Jacques Issoni, Pétain's former defence counsel and the man who led the campaign to rehabilitate the marshal. Subsequently, UNIR became absorbed into the peasant parliamentary group, which itself contained former Vichy supporters.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Quarters. The presence of such a group in the Chamber of Deputies illustrates that France was in many ways still a rural country. But economic development, spearheaded by a set of talented state planners, was taking place rapidly after 1945. Although change affected all sectors of society, it particularly hit small farmers and businesses, groups which had done well during the war, and in the immediate post-war period. With the growth of competition, times became much harder for small producers and retailers. Many were forced to close down or eke out an existence on the margins of survival, while they watched the professional middle class and much of the working class become relatively richer. So, the point that Eatwell is moving towards here is that this would become a viable constituency once again, for French fascism, groups left behind, simmering with resentment, unable to deal with the realities, the economic and social realities that they face, are perfect for fascist exploitation. And we see that not just in the 1930s, but currently right now. If you look at the fascist international that lost its beloved dear leader in Trump, last November, wherever you kind of observe this in action, there is an example of it. These developments set the scene for the sudden explosion of a new political movement. In 1953, a 33-year-old small shopkeeper named Pierre Bougeade helped to organise a demonstration to prevent the hated tax inspector from visiting a neighbour's business. The tactics spread to other villages and towns. Soon Bougeade found himself at the head of a pressure group, the Union for the Defence of Shopkeepers and Artisans, the UDCA, which rallied against the alleged iniquities of the tax system and the uncaring and corrupt nature of the deputies in Paris. This quickly built up a national organisation backed by a variety of newspapers, often specially founded by small-scale printers, who rallied to the cause. By 1955, this organisation had spawned a political party, the French Union and Fraternity, which trumpeted even more strident the Pujadist assault on the system. The small shopkeeper, the Mittelstand, in Weimar Germany was an ideal constituency for the Nazis. Here you have the small business owner who was perhaps a generation previously working class, i.e. Somebody that sold their labour and didn't own property. And the greatest fear is proletarianisation, is losing property and being dragged back down the ladder. The communists, clearly to the small shopkeeper, threaten this, you know, as and threaten the loss of property. But also the iniquities of capitalism, the vagaries of capitalism, that threaten to sweep away savings, you know, for example, during the period of hyperinflation in 1923 in Germany, or during the Great Depression. And these twin kind of economic and ideological hurricanes that seem to blow at the little man, the guy trying to do his best. And fascism appeals, as it can be very appealing in this case, fascism offers really everything, I mean, or promises everything, shall we say, to the small shopkeeper, and offers a kind of a defence against these shapeless, nameless forces. Pujade depicted himself as the typical ordinary man, le petit gars, bought into politics by an unjust and rotten system. Most historians have accepted this self-image, portraying Pujadism either as lacking a clear ideological character or as a form of populism. The truth was rather different. Pujade was brought up in a middle-class family which despised the Republic. In his teens, he'd been involved with Doriot's PPF. In 1940, he'd initially supported the Vichy government, but had fled to Spain as the government's collaborationism became ever greater. In Spain, he travelled to Britain, where he joined the Air Force. After 1945, Pujade initially kept out of politics, but this instinctively political animal was soon re-emerged as an activist in the Gaullist Party. And with the Gaullist demise in 1953, Pujade was looking for a new political vehicle. So here we see quite a cynical character in the guise of Pierre Pujade, who actually was quite the political operator, and the narrative that sprung up around him that was of the little guy campaigning against these big faceless forces. Corrupt bureaucrats, particularly. And he was quite a charismatic figure. He, in the 1950s, travelled through France and met with rapturous applause, often speaking with his sleeves rolled up, and implied that he had all manner of radical positions, and that the little guy, the small man, was the kind of the real soul, the real bedrock of the Republic. By 1955, Pujade was calling for the summoning of an Estates General to produce a new constitution. Of course, the Estates General was famously called in 1789 and sparked the French Revolution. Behind the calls to defend France's interest, especially her colonies, was a strong sense of the threat from the enemy within, which is always said, by which of course he means the Jews. And the Jews were responsible for, in Pujade's eyes, for the iniquities of capitalism and also the corruption of Parliament. Not that they were at all, but that's what he alleged. Although the message appeared to be a classic form of negative populism, there was more than a little element of truth in the nickname given to Pujade by left-wing critics. They called him Pujadolphe. The UFF's main slogan for the January 1956 elections of the National Assembly was kick the old gang out. In his television broadcast before the election, the leader of the Pujadist peasant group concluded that for the next revolution, they would not need the guillotine, as a rope was cheaper and faster and Paris had plenty of lampposts. Amazingly, the UFF won 11.6% of the vote and 52 seats in the elections. An important part of the vote came from artisans, small business owners and farmers who were experiencing hard times and who felt the threat and threatened by change. There was a major protest element too. People who, even in towns and cities, felt some form of hostility towards them who ran the system. Interestingly, in terms of region, Pujadism was often strong in traditionally left-wing areas. This was almost certainly a reflection of the way in which he adopted the rhetoric of the revolution, rather than attack it in the old way of the right-wing groups like Action Française. So Pujadism is a very clever and nebulous force in a way. It managed to shed some of the older kind of hallmarks of fascism. It was able to tack to the left when necessary. It was able to dog whistle racism and colonialism and anti-Semitism when necessary. It used the rhetoric of the revolution as a kind of part of the recognizing this was part of the core founding myth of France, and unlike the clerical fascism, the Catholic fascism of the interwar period, which decried the revolution and said that really that the clock should be turned back and a monarchy restored and the power of the Catholic Church restored and all that, Pujadism recognised that that wasn't viable. I'm sure they would have gone with that if it had been. The other thing to note is that the way in which the Nazis managed to capture public thought and public imagination and public trust during the early 1930s was as a result of the economic crisis of the Great Depression. Here we have a France in the 1950s that isn't facing an economic depression. It is emerging from the humiliation of war and also going through a series of social changes and sort of cultural changes as France begins to rapidly modernise, to embrace the fundamental changes of the post-war world. In terms of urbanisation, town planning, bureaucratisation, and the transition away from it being a largely rural country to it being a modern urban capitalist nation. So here you have a degree of popularity, 11.6%, isn't is no small feat for a party like that. Pujad was able to mask much of his relationship with the Vichy regime, and so perhaps part of the appeal of Pujadism was it was able to address resentments and bigotries and jealousies and hostilities without the toxic connection to the Vichy regime. Anyway, you can catch me. I'm adding quite a lot of content to the Explaining History blog. You can check it out, explaininghistory.org, and there'll be some new stuff going up onto the Explaining History Patreon pretty soon. And I'm just in the planning stages of the first video-based course that I'm going to be putting on the Explaining History website for students. So we're going to be doing Germany 1918 to 1945, but that probably won't be with us for quite a few months, but more news on that as it emerges. Anyway, thanks very much, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.